This is the Hiking Through Life podcast. We've all been gifted a journey called life. Let's see where the journey leads us today.
As previous podcast guest Linda McGurk once said, there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing. The Nordic countries know how to dress right for any adventure. If you're looking for a quality set of wool to keep your kids warm, try Ella's Wool. Some reasons to consider wool? It's warm, it regulates moisture, it's water and odor resistant, and provides a natural sunscreen. In addition to the wool, I love the knit legging tubes. The kids practically lived in their knit legging tubes all winter long for an extra warm layer. Use code HIKINGTL2023 to save 10% off your order. That's code HIKINGTL2023 at ellaswool.com to save 10% off your next order. Do you believe in magic? We do. After we went on our first backpacking trip with two kids under two, we were questioning how on earth we were going to backpack more than one night with two young ones. The gear, carrying the babies, all the pack weight, it's a lot of stuff. But Rory is in the stage of hiking on his own for portions of the trail, and then all of a sudden he sits down and is ready to be carried. You know how this goes. The Trail Magic is the perfect carrier for backpacking families. I'm so excited about this carrier, you guys. It is a carrier designed to attach to your backpacking pack so your child can easily be carried when needed and get back on the trail when needed. The best part is that the Trail Magic carrier folds up to the size of a Nalgene water bottle. Perfect for backpacking.
Use the code HIKE2022 to receive 10% off your order at trailmagic.com. That's magic with a K. Again, the code is HIKE2022, HIKE2022. Use the code for 10% off your order at trailmagic.com and add a little magic to your family's next adventure. Welcome to the Hiking Through Life podcast, where we talk with people who in some way, shape, or form have been influenced by the outdoors. I'm Andy, the producer of this podcast, and my lovely wife, Sarah, will be your host. Together, we make up Hiking Through Life.
This podcast is all about bringing all kinds of people who are inspired by the outdoors and sharing their stories.
We hope that by sharing people's stories, it inspires others to get out and live a more meaningful life. Subscribe to the Hiking Through Life podcast on your favorite podcast provider. If you enjoy this podcast, please share it with others. Also, if you have a story to share, or know of anyone who might be interested in being a guest on this podcast, head on over to hikingthroughlife.net/podcast and get in touch with us.
Welcome to the Hiking Through Life podcast. Today on the podcast, we have Linda McGurk back with us for the second time. She joined us to talk about her first book, There's No Such Thing as Bad Weather, and has since written another book to inspire the open-air lifestyle. Welcome back, Linda.
Thank you so much for having me. So how have you been?
Good. Yeah, since we talked last, I don't even think I had my kiddos when I talked to you. I was not a mom at that point yet.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah, I don't think I was. And yeah, since then we've had, I have two kids now, ages 2.5 and 9 months. So I'm like seeing all the effects of like getting outdoors with kids and just like everything I've been so passionate about, I've now putting into place, and I am seeing some of the challenges of it with little kids.
And every age sort of has, you know, its own phase and its own challenges and rewards. It's interesting. It's really a process, the whole, you know, building a life of outdoorsiness with kids. You know, it's always evolving, so it's never the same. It's interesting.
Yes, it's very much always evolving. And I mean, yeah, like your first book, There's No Such Thing as Bad Weather, like that was like the biggest part for you, I think, when you saw like how the outdoor lifestyle just isn't as much in play here in our country. But since you've written that book, I think so much has evolved in this country.
Yes, for sure. It's amazing to see the strides that have been made. I just I like to point out, like, one measurement of this is just the number of nature preschools in the U.S., which when I started out, there were like a handful, and there was none near me. And today there are over 600 and still growing. And that count was, that's even, I think, like 3 years ago. So that's not even a completely fresh count. And I think that it's interesting as a measurement, just one measurement, and I'm sure there are many others, but just one measurement of how far things have come. And another thing that I've noticed too is just how many different Facebook groups and other online communities there's so many opportunities. And I'm so happy because I had my first daughter in 2008 and I felt so lonely. I wasn't online much then. I started my blog in 2013, and that's really when I started to get into the whole online outdoor world and connecting with others more. Before that, I was pretty offline, and I mean, I had a Facebook account and all, but it wasn't as big then as it is now with, you got Instagram and you can follow different accounts, and there's so much community online, which it sounds so, it sounds counterintuitive that you're going online to find an outdoor community, but it's really important, especially if you're in an area that is just not very conducive to outdoor life, or you just don't, some states are more outdoorsy than others. That's just how it is. And part of that is just, I think, dependent on how much public land there is, how accessible is the outdoors, and how many others are there that are interested, And if you can't find them in real life, then there are all these online communities where you can at least get inspiration and ideas for how can you find these people locally,
Yes. So
it's really great.
Yeah. Well, and your book talks about first of all, the green spaces, we're here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and in your book, you have a few pages that talk about the easy access to green spaces in our city and just how the state of Minnesota has Nordic culture, and we do embrace the outdoors like most of us here, but not all people are like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's in my second book, The Open Air Life. I did use Minneapolis, St. Paul as an example there, because for several years, it seems like Minneapolis, St. Paul always sort of ranks high when organizations do these, they check, which cities are the greenest, I think in the Twin Cities, if I remember right, it's like you can get to a green space within 10 minutes or something. Like they compare all the cities, how easy it is to get to parks and other green spaces, and the Twin Cities always rank very high. So that's great. So I think other cities should look at that and see, what can we learn? Not every city has to reinvent the wheel, and local green spaces are really key to getting outside more. I mean, not everybody can live near wilderness. That's just not realistic. And in the industrialized world, almost 80% of us live in cities today. That's how it is. So I think our best shot of getting outdoors more is to build our cities more like to incorporate nature more in our cities, to make them more like gardens, or plant more trees and have more like urban trails and wildlife refuges and things like that in near urban areas.
Absolutely. Well, I have a friend who lives out in New York, and every time she comes back here to Minnesota, she's just like, wow, I just automatically feel like happier when I come here and see the greenery. Like there's so much truth to it. Yeah. Versus all those, the city life and everything, but there are plenty of parks in New York as well.
Yeah.
And when you're in an apartment too, like I know a lot of people on the 1,000 Hours Outdoor Facebook group, I think that's the biggest challenge too. People who are living in apartments with families and how do they get outside and what can they do? Cause it's so hard to get outside with multiple kids when you're in an apartment.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I can. Yeah, definitely. I think, you just utilizing those nearby spaces is key. And also, getting dressed for it. I think regardless where you live, you know, in the wintertime, if you have kids, if you have multiple kids, you know, getting dressed for an outing is almost, it just seems like so much work sometimes.
It is so much work. And I so many layers
to put on, and like kids don't want to go outside, and it's like this whole chore, but I always think it's worth it. You know, I've never regretted like an outing with a kid. I've regretted not, you know, sometimes not preparing enough or not putting on appropriate clothes and things like that, but it seems like, you know, usually it ends up okay. So
it does. And I mean, you know, that's like what I've learned with kids too, especially a toddler. Like right now, my toddler does not like getting bundled up here in the winter. Yeah. And it's really hard. You kind of just have to, if he doesn't want to bundle up, I just end up taking him out without his mittens on and without his snow pants on. And then, our outdoor time was 10 minutes.
Yeah. But at least you got out. And I'm a big believer in kids making their own experiences. They actually experience that cold against their skin and actually become cold. They're probably not going to listen, you know. So that's usually that's just usually what I do with my kids. Like, okay, you don't want to listen to me, I'll just bring the mittens along in case you change your mind, you know?
Right. And, well, are your kids still like that? Because now your girls are like teenagers. When you wrote there's no such thing as bad weather, they were like, how old were they?
I started writing it when I wrote most of it, my youngest was like 4 and my oldest was 7. And now they're 12 and 15. So yeah, it's very different. Do they still dress the way I want them to dress outdoors? No, the 15-year-old, definitely not. but at this point, I feel like that's just how teens are. They're just not going to dress for the weather. And it's like, they're okay with that, I suppose. I'm like, I keep saying, well, I think you're going to get cold. Or are you sure you want to wear your nice pants? You know, we're going to the woods. It's muddy, you know? And if she still wants to do that, and then okay, it's just
I think that's a little like reassuring to hear coming from you, because I mean you've been getting your kids outside since they were born. This is just your open air lifestyle, so it's good to hear that even your teenager is kind of going against the grain of dressing properly.
Even if she were to get cold, there's no way that she was going to admit it anyway. So, but with the younger one, she often goes camping with me, and she knows that it's really important. If you're going to be out for any amount of time, I mean, it also depends on what you're doing. If we're just going for a walk, like around the neighborhood here, and I know we're going to be out for an hour tops, then there's not, the damage is going to be limited, and the kids are really old enough at this point to make that judgment for themselves. But my younger one, she's really good about it still, because when we go camping, she doesn't want to be cold at night. And I do make her pack her own bag, and I've done that from an early age. I think it's important for kids to learn that sort of risk management thinking, that, okay, what am I going to need? What am I going to need to survive, to survive in the wild, you know, for 48 hours. So whatever. And then they get that sort of thinking from the start, and it's just helpful, you know, down the road, I think.
Oh yeah, yeah, it absolutely is. And so I'm also so curious, because so this is a different topic, but so you, well, kind of similar, just going back to winter.
Yeah.
I remember this video that you had recently posted on your own Facebook page, just talking about how like your own challenges of getting outside in the winter, like even the open air lifestyle, like, yeah, is
yeah.
great, but even you struggled with that.
Oh yeah. And I always try to be transparent about that, because I don't want people to get like unrealistic expectations. Because a lot of times, like in the wintertime here, and because I live in Sweden now, I moved back a few years ago, and we're so far north that our days are super short in the wintertime. And you know, seasonal affective disorder, I mean, it's a real condition, and people are affected by it, and which can make the winter months really tough here. Like December and January especially are very dark, and also the weather had just been, and I know I say there's no such thing as bad weather because I always go outside anyway, but it's just been very sometimes we can go like a month without seeing the sun, and it does have an effect on you. I mean, we are dependent on sunlight for our hormone regulation. Like that is really, that can really help us, you know, help regulate sleep and all that. It regulates our melatonin and also adrenaline and cortisol, which are the hormones that sort of help us get going in the morning, and then it helps regulate the onset of the melatonin at night to tell us that, okay, it's time to wind down and go to sleep. When we don't, if we don't get outside and get that daylight, then that can have a negative effect on our health. And so that's, you know, why sometimes I just sit here in the wintertime and I really don't feel like going outside. It's just the rain is just pounding and it's windy, and it's just, yeah, I'm just like not motivated. And I make myself do it because I feel like because I know that I'm going to feel better afterwards. I know I'm going to have such a good feeling coming back inside into my warm home, and I'm going to just feel refreshed, and I'll be able to focus and, you know, again. And I want to be transparent about having those sort of low days too. And because I like being very active in the wintertime. I like skiing and ice skating. And because it's been a very mild winter here, we haven't been able to do either of those things very much around here. So, so that's, you know, when two of my favorite things just go out the window, then you just have to reframe the situation. Like that's, you know, that's what I tell people to do as well.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, that's kind of like what Fru Less Leave is kind of about, right? Just kind of like embracing what you have right in front of you and making the most of it. Because just before I got on with you, I was talking with my husband about something in your book too. It was like, you don't have to have all the like motor vehicles to go out and go camping and the RVs and the trucks and everything. Yeah, that might make it more of an experience, but just embracing what's right in front of you is all you can. If that's all you can do, then that's going to make your life that much better.
So I like to quote Arthur Ashe, the tennis player. He always said, start where you are, use what you have, and like do what you can. And I think that really applies to Fri Less Leve as well. And maybe to explain this phrase a little bit, Fri Less Leve, it sort of loosely translates to open air life in English. And it is like an old outdoor tradition in the Nordic countries. It sort of dates back to the 1850s when people really felt a need to get away from all the factories and the noise and the cities, in which you can imagine that was like, you know, in the mid 1800s, and like compared to what we have today, it would have been pretty mild. But already back then, people felt the need to reconnect with the countryside. And so So that kind of became the sort of the catch-all phrase for just living simply and being outdoors and sort of connecting with nature sort of on a deeper level. And to this day, friluftsliv is non-motorized. So it's basically you propel yourself by, you know, by foot or by bike or canoe, but not with ATVs and things like that, because the idea is that you really want to get close to nature and you want to have that sort of a slow nature experience. And it's also non-competitive. So it's all about just being in nature without feeling any pressure to achieve anything or accomplish anything. It's fine to not have an agenda, to just sort of go outside and see, just for the sake of going outside, you know, that's like the means and the end, like, to explore your nearby nature areas above all, because they are the ones that are accessible to you on a daily or at least near daily basis. And then on the weekends and on vacations and so forth, you can venture farther and get to, you know, wilder places and hopefully even stay out and camp overnight. But it's really a good, it's a lifestyle. It's about establishing this rhythm early on so that you sort of carry it on or carry it into adolescence and adulthood, because it's something that you can do, you know, your entire life. In contrast, I think a lot of kids today, there's just so much focus on school and academics and also on sports, and neither of which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But when you think about it, sports is often something that kids do very intensely for a few years. And then once they start, you know, maybe they'll play in high school, but once they start college, only a few of the kids will keep playing their sport. And friluftsliv is really something, if that's something that you start early on, chances are you're going to keep doing that, I think, your entire life. I've seen it. I see it here, you know, in Scandinavia, where a lot of older people, that's like their main, that, you know, I don't want to say hobby because it's more of a lifestyle, but it's like how they get outside to do their daily walks. It's like, yeah, sacred almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and in your book, you talk about how this lifestyle can help like with dementia and just people who are in memory care homes, and having open spaces, outdoor spaces and memory care homes is so important for elderly people. And just the whole lifestyle, even for non-elderly people, non-dementia patients, is such a self-care routine.
Yeah, it benefits people of all ages, really. And we start already in infancy, you know, with taking babies outside to nap, you know, all year round. And the babies, they have so much neurological development going on in that first year. It's really amazing. So I think people tend to undervalue the development that goes on during that first year. And to not think, you know, you think that, well, they can't talk and they can't, I mean, there's so many things that they can't do outside, but there are definitely so many benefits to having them out there and still experiencing nature with all their senses outside. They can definitely, you do tummy time like outside, and I think a lot of people are worried about babies like sticking dirt in their mouths forth.
That's one of the biggest concerns I see people writing on groups.
Yes. And for sure, like for babies who are that age, you have to be cautious to make sure there aren't any small objects that they can stick in their mouths. But I think we worry too much about dirt. It's a pretty recent phenomenon, this whole super sanitized environment that we're putting babies in, and it's not all good. Like, they do need exposure to some germs outside as well. It's only going to help their immune system develop, because their immune systems are immature, so they need that exposure. And it's not to be confused with the viruses and bacteria that cause illnesses. That's something else, really.
Yeah. That it's so important for them, the outdoor air and the germs, mm-hmm. too. That's a huge thing. Like, when I know when my baby puts like a little leaf in their mouth or like some dirt, it's not a big deal to me. I don't worry about it. Yeah. If there's like a pebble going in or something, I watch them. I'm mm-hmm. always watching the baby outside, yeah. of course. But
yeah.
yeah, it's not something that I'm too overly worried about. Right. But one thing here is like there is and when kids eat snow too, I don't worry when kids eat snow, but then there are certain things like, well, you got to make sure they're not eating like the chemicals from the salt on the road.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's all about, you know, where you are, and whether it's okay or not. I mean, that's just a judgment call. You have to make, you know, yeah, don't put them down where, like in the dog park, maybe if there's a lot of like dog feces and on the ground, that's obviously not a good place. But with, you know, my philosophy has always been common sense goes a long way. So I've just usually used my gut feeling with a lot of these child rearing issues. Gut feel,
yeah.
and common sense go yeah. a long way.
So I'm so curious. So with your book, There's No Such Thing as Bad Weather and Open Air Life, for people who haven't read either of them, which book do you think would be better to read first?
I think it depends a little bit on who you are. Like, if you don't have kids and don't have any plans to have kids, I would probably start with The Open Air Life, because that's a little more general. It's geared more towards the general audience, even though it does talk some about children and Friluftsliv as well, and how to incorporate it in children's lives. But if you have kids, I would probably start with There's No Such Thing as Bad Weather, just because it's not that The Open Air Life is like a sequel, but it does talk about my kids when they're older. So it would make more sense to start with There's No Such Thing as Bad Weather, because that's when they're little. And that's kind of where you get the background as well, and what, like, my journey from Sweden to the US and the sort of the culture clash. And then I talk a little bit about Friluftsliv in that book, but then The Open Air Life is really that goes into Friluftsliv in more depth. So that focuses more on a part of what I talk about in my first book. So that would probably be the most natural progression for most people, I think.
Yeah. Well, and what I love about Open Air Life is just like, you talk about simple ways that you can embrace the open air life in your own lifestyle, like, or in your own life on an everyday basis. Like, one thing yes. I really like about it is, like page 9 just talks about like the different types of walks you can do, and you use all the Swedish terms, and like, I would butcher all of them, but it's like barefoot walk, stroller walk,
yeah,
evening walks, like just all really easy ways to incorporate this lifestyle into your everyday activities. And like, I know stroller walks were like a big thing once we had babies, like we had to find stroller friendly walks. Like, before we were always on the trail, but now like, sometimes we just want a stroller instead of putting our kid on our back.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Swedish has so many different terms for walking. So it's interesting, because I think it is a reflection of the culture. You know, we do a lot of walking, and that's a lot of what Friluftsliv is about. I think that's like the most, when people ask me, you know, well, what kind of activities is Friluftsliv? And then it's like, well, First of all, it's not mainly a set of activities. It's more like a lifestyle and a mindset of being in close to nature. But if we are to talk about activities, then walking would probably, I mean, definitely be the most common one, just because it's the easiest, you know, easiest one to do. Usually you can just go out of your home and walk somewhere. I mean, not for everybody. I do realize that not all communities are walkable, especially in the U.S. And that's something where city planning needs to catch up. Like, we definitely need more walkable spaces and more parks and green spaces. But for most people, that's the lowest hanging fruit, and it can still have like a really big impact. I mean, I even read a story or a study where they tried to quantify like the amount of time that you need to be walking or being outside every day to get like the maximum health impact. And it came down to about half an hour per day. That's like you can get like really high health impact just from walking half an hour per day. So I think that's like, if you have a hard time fitting this into your lifestyle, because I know I get a lot of questions about that, and a lot of people feel like, well, I'm too busy, you know, but then start with that and see where it takes you. Chances are you'll crave more and more of it. And if you can't do it during the work week, you know, try to spend some longer chunks of time on the weekend getting out more.
Yeah,
I think it benefits the whole family.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really great tip. If it's just a half hour, especially, like, I mean, I know time is so precious to everybody, but a half hour isn't really that much. And yeah. I mean, I know, especially with kids, like, I've started to have to go outside on my own in the mornings, even before they wake up or something.
Yeah.
Just to, like, get outside on my own, because sometimes I don't want to bundle my kids up on a daily
basis.
Sometimes it's just not, I'm, especially in the cold, I just don't feel like doing it. But I know for my own mental well-being, like, I'm carving that time out. I wasn't for a while, and I was totally feeling like the winter blues depression kicking in.
Yeah. Yes. And there are studies on that too, showing that for like light symptoms of depression, like just getting outside and getting that daylight can be just as effective as pharmaceuticals. So, you know, it's very powerful. And it's like, why don't we talk more about this? But I suppose it's because nobody's making money off of people walking outside. So.
Exactly. Walking is free.
Yes. So, but it's something we all need to do more. I personally can't get enough of it. It's my go-to mode of self-care. It's a must have for me. And I'm glad, like, you know, having been raised in this culture, it makes it very easy because everybody around you kind of thinks the same way. So that makes it more like, if you're at work and at lunch, you know, people will be up for going out. And if it's a sunny day, you know, chances are you'll end up having your lunch outside. Maybe you'll go for a walk down to a nearby park and just sit there and have your lunch. And everybody will be like, you know, all excited about that and want to do the same thing. So it does help when the whole culture is sort of used to that way of thinking. But I think we can live a lot more outdoors in the U.S. as well, and especially some states, definitely, you know, where the climate is warmer too, they definitely have a perfect setup for it, which we don't have here in the Nordic countries. Even if we try to be outside a lot in the wintertime, it is going to be a little less than in the summertime for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I know I was recently down in Arizona and I was like, wow, just stepping outside and not bundling up is like such a, I like forget how easy it can be when you live in such a warmer climate. But then, you know, like if you don't live in a warmer climate, you don't have all the seasons. And I think there's something so beautiful about the open air lifestyle and embracing all the seasons and the changes that do come along with it.
Yes, for sure. I mean, and that's another reason why I do want to be outside all year round, is because I want to see my favorite places, you know, at all times of the year, to see what they look like. And also because it helps me get to know the community, my local community, and the local nature areas. So you got to be out there to get to know them and to know what it feels like on a really cold day, and to just experience it. Yeah. And I want my kids, I definitely want my kids to have that experience too. I don't want them to hibernate half the year, because they would be hibernating a long time here if they shied away from inclement weather.
And one thing I think you were talking about in a different podcast, or maybe I read this summer, was you were starting like screen-free Sundays with your girls. Mm-hmm. Is that something you're still doing?
Yeah, it's something we started a few years ago, because I felt like we were all getting too dependent on our screen. We're spending too much time on our screens. And to some extent, it's inevitable. Like for myself, for sure. Like I work as a writer. This is my computer, is my lifeline.
Yeah. It's Sunday today and you're on a scroll.
I know, right?
Yeah.
It's very hard, but I've noticed that the phones, especially the smartphones, are like huge time suckers. And especially for the kids, I felt like, no, we need to do something different. We need Sundays. We need at least one day a week to be at first we said screen free. Now it's like screen reduced. So heavily screen reduced, because I noticed it was just too hard. Like just like navigating to a park that I hadn't been to before. It's like, how am I going to do that without the GPS in my phone? It's like, no matter how hard I tried.
I know it's back before we had smartphones, we had to like look directions up online before, like print them off or write them down.
So I was like, no, that's where I draw the line. I'm not going to get lost over this. So now we do try to do little, like get outside for longer chunks of time. We try to plan a week in advance sometimes if we're going to do something, go a little farther. And we all sort of chip in ideas for things that we want to do on the weekend together. I do think it's important though to get that family time on the weekend, even though my kids are older now. It is one of the main ways that we connect, really. Friede Sleeve is, like I said, it's multi-generational. It's perfect for spending time together as a family. We do try to do those still. We've just, my youngest one and I were just out camping last night, actually. We've been doing some winter camping, so that was part of this weekend's screen-free activity.
And was this just right in your yard, or you went somewhere?
No, we actually drove. We drove for about 45 minutes and ended up camping in the woods somewhere. And way out where I've never been before. But because we have all the right to roam here, we're not just confined to parks, so we can basically camp in any nature area, except some nature preserves, but like any forest is pretty much free game. So we can pitch a tent and have a little campfire and hike pretty much anywhere on private or public land. So it's another sort of pretty unique feature of Sweden, Norway, and Finland, especially, and to some extent in Iceland too, and Scotland has it too, to some extent, the right to roam.
Oh, I didn't know Scotland had it either.
It's pretty new there, but they've had it for about 20 years, I think.
So yeah, no, but going with the whole, like, just being able to go disperse camping kind of everywhere, like, yes, there is some of that here in the United States, but it's not as easily accessible. And especially yeah. like here in Minnesota, like you need to go like up north to National Forest. There are some areas within the Twin Cities where you can go, but it's not as easy access yeah. and it's not very, some of them aren't well maintained necessarily. So like right. people who have RVs and stuff who want that comfort might not be able to get yeah. into them as easy. But then that also comes up with like the three forms of frulift sleeve that you talk about in your book. Frulift sleeve. Yeah, like the three forms of it. So like you were right. saying with your daughter, you were just on an overnight camping trip. So that's almost like a weekend frulift sleeve.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and then there's the daily frulift sleeve is what we've been talking about previously. It's like, you know, you're really nearby areas, which could be more urban if you live in a city. But the spaces that you can really easily get to on a daily or near daily basis. And then I highly recommend too that at least once or twice a year that people really try to get away from civilization and really try roughing it for a week or so if you can. That's really when you get the best sort of restorative effect. I mean, I think any time outdoors is beneficial. There's no doubt about that. But in every study that has compared like a walk along a busy road with a walk in the park, you know, the walk in the park always wins. It's more restorative. That's just we can't get away from that. So of course when you compare a park with a really wild place too, then the wilder place is going to be more restorative because there's just less noise pollution. There's less light pollution. There's less people, less traffic, and all those stimuli normally have the effect like they arouse us, but not necessarily in a good way. Like they are the kind of input that can make us feel stressed, whereas in nature we're more relaxed, and there's a number of theories behind that. Scientists aren't completely in agreement on why that is. There are a lot of there have been a lot of studies on it, and some of the theories sort of overlap and complement each other. And I think the most likely explanation is probably a combination of several. Part of it is biological. We have this, you know, that we feel that we crave blue and green spaces because, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, that's where we've gotten our food and our water. That's how we survive, right? By seeking out green spaces and blue spaces. And then there's another theory that thinks it's linked to the oxytocin and yet other theories that talk about the attention restoration theory, which believes that in nature it's more the attention is more effortless. It doesn't require any concentration, you know, to just sit and listen to a waterfall or to just look at the clouds. It's effortless, as opposed to driving through busy traffic or solving a math problem, which requires a lot more of our directed attention. So I think it's a combination of several theories really that make us, to me, it's not even that important. I don't really care that much about why. I know that it works, so that's why I keep doing it. I will leave the why to the scientists, and I will just do it.
Right, absolutely. And it's like, it's kind of something you, like, it's a lifestyle, like we've been talking about. It's Like, I think if someone just goes out and goes for a walk one day and then just never does it again, the benefit's not going to stay with you. It has to be, it has to become part of your lifestyle. And like, you guys are just raised like that over there in the Nordic countries. And unfortunately here, like, people really have to make an effort to do that and be very intentional about that.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's what I had to do when I moved to the US and I had my kids in Indiana. I noticed that, okay, I'm going to need to be intentional. If I want my kids to have any, you know, a childhood that's going to be anything like the one I had, then I really have to make an effort, because here it's sort of, it's just baked into everything, like preschool and daycare. You know, they're outside all the time. That's what daycare, that's what really early childhood is about here. It's like all the parents just want their kids to be outside and playing in the mud. Nobody really expects little children to be practicing, you know, letter tracing or preparing for kindergarten. It's like before they're six or seven, there's really no concerted effort to teach kids to read. You know, it's just all about play here in the early years, and especially outdoors. So that was one of the differences that I encountered. And I knew that in a way, I think it brought out the friluftsliv brain in me. I became even more devoted to it after I moved to Indiana and I had kids. If I would have stayed in Sweden, I probably would have been more like, you know, just your average Swede. But now I really, really delved into it and I went a lot farther than my parents did with me. I can tell you that, doing more, I don't want to call it extreme, because it's really, I don't consider what I do extreme, but doing more longer camping trips with the kids and by myself and hiking solo with the kids and overnight trips and all that, in a way that I might never have done had I stayed here, because it would have been more, my kids would have been outside all day at preschool, and they would have come home and with rosy cheeks and all that. And I would have felt like, okay, well, that's great. They were already outside all day. So.
Yeah. It's kind of like you don't really know what you have till it's gone. Like you really, like it's all about going back to your roots and like what you were raised with and value.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm really glad that I had that experience. It was really good, in that you don't really know what you have until you lose it. But then again, like you said, there's so much positive change going on right now that it's been a lot of fun to have been part of that movement too, with my first book and that. So I think parents definitely have to be vigilant, because institutions take a lot of time to change. Even the schools that have the most sort of enthusiastic teachers who really want to, you know, start that school garden and have that outdoor classroom, they can be up against a lot of resistance sometimes. So I think you just have to accept that change can take a lot of time, unless, well, sometimes, as we noticed during COVID, a lot of those outdoor classrooms all of a sudden just popped up because it became, all of a sudden, it was a necessity. So change can happen really fast when you're forced to make it. And hopefully some of that will stick. I'm hoping.
Yeah, definitely. I know. So I think the first time I talked to you, we had just kind of started an outdoor classroom where I was teaching. I'm not teaching anymore now because I stay home with the kids now. Yeah. But yeah, we started the outdoor classroom because of COVID. So it was just kind of out of like chaos. But that school district is still doing the outdoor classroom, and they're thriving in it, and parents love it. They keep asking for it. So it's become a very sought out thing here. And I know in our state, at least, there's even just like a map of outdoor preschools that you can find. And again, it still is the preschool level and not necessarily above yet. There's certain schools right. that are, but more and more so, it's a slow process, like you said.
Yes, it is. It's changing a mindset, and that takes time. But I'm hopeful. Lots of good signs. So I think part of the reason why I wrote my books is because I want people to read it, and I want parents to start wanting that for their kids too, because I think collectively parents can have a lot of influence too. But I think it has to come. That demand has to come from the parents and from the teachers and from, I mean, there has to be a collective, I think, a collective change, because it's hard for the schools to make changes if the parents resist and vice versa. I remember teachers telling me that they worried about having kids outside at recess if it was raining, because they would get so many complaints from the parents. And so that's where I'm hoping that my books will sort of help change some of that. And so that more parents will really appreciate and understand like the benefits of being outside all year round. And maybe even want to make it part of their family culture, because it really, you know, it's really a holistic approach. It has, you know, it has benefits on so many different levels. Yeah, there are the health benefits for sure, but that I wouldn't even say that they are the main driver. It's not, I feel good when I go outside, but I don't go out thinking consciously that I'm going to go outside now to get my vitamin D so I don't get osteoporosis, and I'm going to, you know, decrease my risk of heart attack by like 30%.
Exactly.
You know, that's not how I think when I go out for my daily walk. I just go out because I know it's refreshing and it helps me focus better at work. And just because I enjoy being in nature, I like listening to the birds and the leaves and the water and the creeks. Because it's also, to me, that's almost like a spiritual experience. So there's just so many different levels. And also, I really want my kids to be connected, to have that connection, because I want them to fight for nature. I mean, Mother Nature is going to need, we're up against some pretty tough challenges here. And we're going to need these children to grow up and to be adults who really care about nature, to make, you know, adults who make wise decisions about the environment and don't view nature as just a resource or just something else that you can just extract resources from indefinitely, but something that is a part of us, something that we are one with nature, really. And that's, you get that whole holistic view with Friluftsliv, that we're all a part of it and we need to take care of it.
Right, right. And there's so many different levels of that. And it just goes back to not having to achieve or compete in this Friluftsliv lifestyle. I think that's such the important piece of it too. Cause, you know, yeah. I think over here, especially, like, there can be, there's just become so much competition with like the right gear and just like all the things you can do outside. And it's especially when social media is right in front of us, people are constantly seeing, oh, like, and competing within your own heads of it. But that's not what the lifestyle is about.
Right. No, for sure. To keep it simple. You don't need. You don't need a ton of gear or a ton of equipment. What you need, especially if you do live in a cold climate, the kids will need warm, waterproof clothes to stay out for any amount of time. So that's where your first priority should be, to get proper clothing, and especially the outer layer is really important to to protect against the weather. I'm pretty sure I did not have any merino wool underwear when I grew up. It was like in the 80s. People just did whatever. It's like, yeah, you bundled kids up, but it wasn't like my parents had the whole layering system figured out. I mean, it was just common sense. Like, okay, it's cold out, we'll put on more clothes, you know. But I did not have like the $200 merino wool undergarments at that time. So just, yeah, if you're on a budget, put your money towards the outer layer. That's my advice.
Right. Well, and I think in your book, even you said, like, if things like rip or stop things, like, just fix it. Like, that's a great mindset to be in too, because then you're reducing the waste.
Yes, for sure. And if you can buy the quality gear and just buy a little at a time, that's great too. Like, I had hiking boots that I've had for 10 years. No kidding. I mean, that ends up being pretty cheap entertainment if you divide that on 10 years. So
absolutely.
They were worth every penny.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very, what do you think about it as your entertainment? It's endless possibilities when you have just some of the right gear. And again, it's not all the like high end fancy gear. And
right.
And now with social media at our fingertips, it's like there's so many ways to access the gear. There's many Facebook groups for it now.
Yes. And even apps where you can rent gear cheaply from other people. Like, the whole sharing economy has opened up a lot of doors, I think. So that's a great way of doing it. If you're not sure if camping is like really your thing, like, don't go out and buy all the stuff. Rent it first and then try it out and see if it's your thing. And if it is, I mean, camping is really one of the most inexpensive things that you can do if you're going to travel compared to like staying at a hotel or pretty much anywhere else. So from that perspective, Friluftsliv is, you know, it's good that it's accessible, I think, to people from a lot of income levels. I think geographical distance is a bigger hurdle, like getting places for families who might not have a car or own a car, and where public transit is not the best, then that's where you're going to have like the big challenges. But that's also where we're seeing some really interesting projects sprouting up in more urban areas too, where Atiyah Wells, for example, I can't think of her the name of her project right now, but she what she has created from just, I think, like some abandoned space in the city center that can really, you can turn it into something beautiful, like a community garden or a community outdoor space for kids to come and plant things. And there's just so many possibilities, really. It just takes a few passionate souls to get it started. And I think I'm seeing it in a lot of places right now.
Yeah. So that's so interesting. Do you think if you were living here now in America, in the USA, raising your girls back when they were young, would you had been more like, would you have enjoyed raising them at this point now with where our country is now?
Yeah, I think I would have. Yeah, I think I would have done some things differently. I think I definitely would have made a bigger effort to find people locally to go and have just outdoor adventures with. I think I would have had much better possibilities for that today, to find those, you know, opportunities. I mean, I did to some extent, but they were mostly people I already knew, like just a few families that would come with us and do things. But had it been today, I would have I probably would have championed some sort of like outdoor play group or something to that effect. I still think Indiana is hard. It's harder because there's just so little public land there, but there are some really nice parks. It's just that you have to drive a little ways, or at least I had to drive from where I lived. I lived in a rural area, but because there's so much private land and most of it is cornfields or soybean fields, there's just not, like, you're in the country, but there's not a lot of hikeable areas, you know? So there, it was almost like I had more places to walk when I lived in the city, ironically enough, but that's just how it is sometimes, you know?
Right, right. And you kind of just gotta make the most of what it is right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you have to drive to a park, then that's just kind of what you gotta do. And
yeah,
it's once you start doing it, it becomes you're ingrained in you.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what I learned too while I was over there was to simplify too. So when we couldn't go, when camping was not an option, or when that was seemed like too big of an effort, then a lot of times we, and I talk about this in my book too, we would sleep outside on our deck. So that became like this thing that we did on a regular basis, especially like during the summer months. We would just, yeah, we would move out our duvets and just sleep on our outdoor furniture. And it was just, we had some of our most amazing nights there, and just looking up at the stars. And it was, I have a lot of good memories from Indiana. And I don't want people to think that I left because I didn't, because I didn't like Indiana. It was not, you know, there were more complex reasons than that, for leaving, and a lot of them, just personal and just missing family and all that. And so, by me moving to Indiana and really, I think it made me like really refocus on the whole food estate culture and look at it from a different, in a new light, really, from somebody who lived in Indiana at the time. And I tried to look at how can I apply this right here where I live now. And I think I was successful in that. And that's also what I wanted to share in my second book.
Yeah.
Because I think it's very doable in a lot of, you know, in most places, really, because it does focus on your nearby nature. It does focus on what you have and not just the pristine wilderness areas, which are not accessible for a majority of the people.
Absolutely. I love the idea of just camping, like with your stuff right outside of your house. Like that's something so many of us don't think of. And it's like, just for young kids, that's such a cool experience. They would think that's the coolest thing ever. And they'd probably ask for it over and over again. And just the whole idea of that, like, especially like becoming a mom in the past 2 years, like the whole free less leave lifestyle is really how I've had to embrace the outdoors, just like make the outdoors part of my everyday lifestyle. Cause before kids, I was like all about like, I'm going to go on this 4-day backpacking trip. We're going to walk 10 miles a day. Like we're going to do all of this. And now like it's none of that. And I've really had to like embrace this whole, just bring it into your lifestyle every single day. And like your book is so inspiring for that. And I think so inspiring for so many people in so many outdoor groups. Like I see your book talked about all the time and it's just like amazing, the inspiration that it's brought.
Thank you. Yeah. We'll see what the next book will be about. I don't know.
Yeah. Has it started yet?
I'm mulling a couple of different ideas, but nothing firm yet. So not ready to share anything yet. But I'm definitely, I definitely feel like there's a need for another book. I'm still getting questions, and as long as I keep getting questions, I feel like there's a need.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I just think it's your concept of it and the free lift sleeve and the Swedes is just it's a very simple concept. And it's maybe people are just thinking of it too complexly, that it's the simple form of it just isn't there.
Yeah, Right. I do think when people think of like outdoor recreation in the U.S., a lot of times people think of the more like hardcore, you know, like the rock climbers or like the more extreme adrenaline, you know, infused activities, whereas friluftsliv really is more inclusive. It is about just having a good time outside and just doing it in very simple ways and just using what you have and just enjoying yourself. And you don't have to be an expert. It's definitely, it helps to know some basic skills, but the beauty of it is that you can learn like alongside your child. You know, you don't I'm still learning all the time new things, and it's, that makes it fun for me too, because I feel like there's always something new to learn, and because it has that non-competitive air to it, it's like you don't have to be embarrassed to ask, or it's always great to go with somebody who is more experienced than you at something. And so that's how I learned how to mushroom, for example. I would go with people who knew, and then I'd become more and more confident, and I'd, you know, read some books and just gain that skill. And I learned that in my 40s, you know, so it's not static by any means. You can have some basic skills and just get out there and you learn as you go. I've done that with camping and hiking and a lot of things, and it's trial and error, and just keep the adventures at your level, you don't want to put yourself at risk or your kids at risk, obviously. So a good, if you're not sure about camping or how to do it, then start in your backyard or start in where you can easily get to your car, or do it in a place that you're familiar with. Yeah, there are all sorts of ways of just easing yourself into friluftsliv, really.
Right. Yeah. I love that. Just start where you're comfortable with it. Like don't try to compare yourself to whatever the other person is doing.
Right. Right.
I think that's a beautiful concept of it. Well, yeah. Thank you. This has been awesome. And yeah, my baby has been sleeping outdoors so much lately. And it, like, honestly, my kids sleep outdoors better than they do indoors. Like my toddler doesn't nap anymore, but when he goes outside, it's magical.
Yeah, yeah. That doesn't surprise me. A lot of parents have that experience.
Yeah. So many great things about the culture. I love it. Well, awesome. Thank you for coming on again.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
You've been listening to the Hiking Through Life podcast. Peace, love, and hike through life.